If you're running a business right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, culture wars, the world is rapidly changing around us. And companies, especially independent and local businesses, are having to adapt faster than ever. That's why Mission Critical is evolving. We're diving deep with the founders, CEOs, and entrepreneurs who are navigating this chaos in real time. The ones making the tough calls, pushing through unpredictability, and proving that resilience isn't just a buzzword, it's a survival skill. How do you scale in an economy that feels like it's on shaky ground? What happens when US policy shifts send shockwaves through Canadian industries? And in a world where diversity, healthcare, and economic resilience are becoming battlegrounds, how do businesses double down instead of backing down? These are the real conversations that matter to business leaders right now. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. Every spring, the steps of the Met transform into fashion's most watched runway, the Met Gala. A single red carpet that, for one night, commands the attention of the world. But beyond the couture, spectacle, and celebrity lies something far more revealing. The Met Gala isn't just about what people wear, it's about what we value, who we celebrate, and how we define identity, power, and culture. This year's theme, Superfine, tailoring black style, and its accompanying dress code, tailored for you, placed menswear and suiting front and center. And yet, even with a theme that begged for play and creativity, so many men arrive still tethered to the guardrails of traditional masculinity. Why does that matter? Because the Met Gala is more than just a party, it's a global stage. And how men choose to present themselves on it can tell us everything about what masculinity means today and what it still resists becoming. In this episode of Mission Critical, I speak with Dr. Ben Berry, Dean of Fashion at Parsons School of Design and one of the leading voices redefining fashion education through the lens of equity, access, and justice. Dr. Berry's work explores how fashion functions as more than just clothes on a body. It's a system, a language, a mirror to society. From dismantling narrow ideas of masculinity to rethinking who fashion is made for and who it excludes, Dr. Berry is shaping a new generation of leaders who see fashion as a vehicle for liberation, not limitation. Together, we reflect on the power of style to challenge norms, accessibility, the subtle performances of masculinity across fashion and politics, and what it means to lead a global institution like Parsons with purpose. This is a conversation about the messages our clothes carry, whether on the red carpet, in the classroom, or in everyday life. This is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. Dr. Ben Berry, so lovely to be chatting with you. How are you?
Good. I'm excited to talk.
I am so excited for our discussion today. I feel like we've known each other for like a hot minute, but I've never actually had like a formal discussion with you about your work. And also, like, who doesn't love talking about style and fashion and culture and just how it plays into everything? So I'm excited for our chat today.
Yeah, me too.
So why don't we start off with, if you could just say, you know, introduce yourself quickly for the people in the back that are not as familiar with your work and just kind of like, what's your elevator pitch to the world?
So I am a fashion educator, researcher, you know, former entrepreneur, but still in the academy. I consider myself an entrepreneur and I'm really committed to educating the next generation of fashion professionals and designers to advocate for inclusive fashion. So clothing that is accessible for all people and allows all people to claim space in the world.
And such an interesting time to be talking about that and like the inclusivity and just what that all means kind of within the fabric of the larger discussions we're having. Also, perfect time for us to be talking to because off camera, we were just saying that we are having this discussion right before the Met Gala. And, you know, it's that time of year again, the Met Gala, which is often, you know, heralded as, you know, the biggest night in fashion, is just a few days away from the time of this recording. Let's start off with just a little icebreaker. If you could co-chair next year's Met Gala theme, what would it be, or who would it be with? So who would your co-chair be with? What would be the theme and who would you wear?
Love this question. okay, so I think definitely my co-chair would be my partner for the Parsons Disabled Fashion Student Scholarship Program, Sinead Burke, who is an amazing disability fashion consultant, activist, guest edited an issue of British Vogue that was based on disability. They had a Braille issue, like really doing incredible work. So definitely working with Sinead. I think my theme would be access, because I would love to see how people would interpret that. And I would wear Rebirth Garments, which is an amazing label based out of Chicago that creates clothing that is gender inclusive, that is accessible, that is all sizes, and it has this ethos of radical visibility. So it's using clothes to claim space in the world.
I love that. And this is not really a theme that's been explored very much on, certainly at the Met Gala, but just, I guess, like kind of like in red carpets, on red carpets in general. So I think that that would be such an exciting one to see how people parlay that into their own, and also how designers parlay that into their own kind of visions as well, because there is some really incredible things that are happening out there in terms of like being more like adaptive fashion and being more inclusive and just challenging people to innovate a little bit on the red carpet.
Yeah, and I would even be interested to think, how would we reimagine the red carpet? You think of the Met Gala and you think of those infamous stairs going up, right? And then around the back is an accessible entrance for folks who need that. And so what would that mean with the stairs? How would that be architecturally reimagined as an accessible red carpet? And so I think a theme like that would open up so many possibilities and conversations. And I think when we talk about inclusion and access in fashion, certainly when I'm working with students, it's really like those prompts that then create those possibilities. And I think what I would be excited about with a theme like this is it's not just access for the sake of inclusion or compliance, but it really is, what are the creative possibilities that open up when we start to center the diversity of our bodies, when we start to center access.
That would be very exciting. So this year's dress code is Tailored for You, which will be a nod to the exhibition's focus on menswear and suiting, which, you know, I feel like the guys don't really get that much of a spotlight sometimes when it comes to these things. So I think it's the opportunity and the creativity that can be kind of channeled through menswear and suiting is really exciting. They've got Coleman Domingo, Lewis Hamilton, ASAP Rocky, and Pharrell Williams co-chairing with Anna Wintour, alongside LeBron James as the honorary chair. So, you know, just absolutely stacked, and just people with interesting sartorial perspectives. I think that this year is going to be so interesting, given the perspective of your work as well. With that in mind, what do you think that this year's Met Gala dress code, its choice in its co-chairs, and even just past Met Gala red carpets have revealed about how we define masculinity in culture right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited about, first, the exhibition that this is based on. It's been co-curated with scholar Monica Miller, and really is looking at dandyism, Black sartorial genius, and the ways in which I think, you know, Black people and Black men have used style as a way to both really for liberation, right? To really resist structural oppression. And so I think that this not only creates incredible fashion and styling and like sartorial detail, but it also is about the politics of style. And so I think when what I'm looking for on the red carpet, or what I'm excited for, is really that intersection between fashion and politics. Recognize that fashion, you know, has been used and continues to be used as a weapon against so many communities and people, not allowing us to be ourselves, excluding people from having the opportunity to even like find clothing that fits their bodies or meets their budget and be their full self. But also how fashion has been used in these incredible forms of resistance to claim visibility, to claim like confidence in your body, to move through space. And so I think it's really this intersection with politics that I'm looking forward to seeing how people bring back to the carpet, because that certainly is the ethos of this exhibition.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's, there's such a, especially within the larger zeitgeist right now, just such an incredible opportunity to talk about how the textiles and the clothing that we wear on our bodies are also just vessels for larger conversations and a reflection of the moment in time that we're in right now too. Like a lot of what we wear is a reflection of like our values, our, you know, what's going on in the world in a given moment, whether that's through the lens of accessibility or sustainability or innovation, even things like the liberation of like, you know, gender and the commentary on gender as well too. Like it's just so interesting when you really try to unpack what it all means.
I'm really excited. I mean, I'm looking, I think one of the things that's so interesting about this theme as well is it's not just about the professional designer, right? Or the designer that's the creative director of this house that we all might know, but very much of this exhibition. And I think the theme is also about the ways everyday people use fashion to speak back to a culture that oppresses them, to claim space in the world, and thinking about the ways in which folks, you know, style outfits, make outfits at home, you know, hack things to work for their bodies, really that individual, like, creativity, aesthetic expression, like, genius that people have, particularly people that have been excluded from fashion or haven't had access to, right, designer clothing, or haven't had, right, whose pathways to a traditional fashion world have been closed, but have used their own creativity to really create their own outfits that have been radical and political. And I think that that is such an important part of this theme. And I think we're seeing that obviously with menswear and tailoring, and the ways often, you know, Black men have embraced dandyism as a sartorial style to claim space. I think some of that ongoing lineage is what I hope people pull for the red carpet. But I think it also challenges the idea that it's only a professional fashion designer who is quote a designer, but it is giving homage to folks and their everyday fashion practices and recognizing that that is also part of a fashion system and fashion design.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, the Met Gala is for many people a sense of, you know, offers a sense of fantasy and escapism in many ways, but it's also a lot about, you know, influence and impact. From your perspective and through the lens of your work, what kind of what have you seen in terms of the types of, you know, masculine identities that have been celebrated, and also then conversely, which ones have been left out or tokenized? We see kind of a diversity of different outfits on the red carpet, but what does it mean through the lens of your work?
Yeah, I think we've definitely started to see, certainly within the past decade, more and more, not just at the Met, but red carpets in general, fashion in general, we've seen this like really plurality of menswear styles. And I think that, you know, that has been really exciting to see, just so many different aesthetics, one that are available now in menswear, right? The recognition that menswear is like not just an emerging industry, but is really a robust industry. Mm-hmm. And that there are so many aesthetics rather than just one that allow both men, masculine people, people who wear menswear, you know, to choose from and play with. And I think we're starting to see what that looks like on a red carpet in more traditionally masculine suiting and clothes that maybe play more with gender, play more with femininity, clothes that are more androgynous, clothes that mix all of this together, that have different cultural influences. So I think that like folks that wear menswear, we are seeing so many options more, certainly from ready to wear than we've seen before. Mm. From my work, I think it's always, well, which bodies have access to those clothes, right? Like, which are the bodies that are deemed, right, not just allowed or right to wear particular outfits, but that actually can find these outfits in sizes, you know, in certain like aesthetic functions that actually work for them. And I think often we're still seeing that it's like, you know, lean or toned bodies. We're seeing it certainly like, you know, non-disabled folks who have access to these clothes. And I think, you know, as an educator, certainly at my time at TMU and also now at Parsons, part of what, you know, I work with students and with my colleagues is how can we make sure that like, right, these aesthetics are available to all bodies, but not only that, what happens when we begin with, you know, larger plus size fat bodies? What happens when we begin with disabled bodies? What then new aesthetics, new silhouettes, new design possibilities open up? And I think that we're starting to see this inclusion, but it's inclusion to a certain extent in menswear. And so I think that that really is kind of the next phase of the work, is to make sure that like this incredible creative, like creativity and panorama of styles are available to more and more bodies. Because we are seeing, right, this homogenous sort of form of which bodies wear these outfits on the red carpet, and certainly which ones, you know, can access it when they go to retail.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was reading some of your work, and you said in one of your pieces that quote, men strategically shift their clothing based on their identities and context to garner opportunities and shore up masculinity, which I thought was super interesting. Can you unpack that for us and what that kind of reveals about the way, one, masculinity, why like masculinity is both fragile and negotiated, and how fashion is used to protect or project it in a way too?
Yeah, I mean, for some context, I engaged in this 3-year research project called Refashioning Masculinity. And at the heart of it, I did these wardrobe interviews with about 50 different like men and masculine people in Toronto. And wardrobe interviews are when you literally just hang out in someone's wardrobe with them. You ask them to give you a tour of all their clothes. And, you know, you talk about, where did you get this? What does this mean to you? Where did you last wear it? And it's really using garments like really as prompts for conversation, but also recognizing the knowledge that clothing holds in relation to our bodies as wearers. So it's just a very fun project. And one of the, I think, findings in that is that often, you know, the dominant kind of narrative is, oh, that clothing for men is often a passive decision, or they're just going to wear, you know, whatever is there. There's not a lot of thought that goes into it, really taking, again, these like tropes about, you know, the men are distancing themselves from fashion. And I think what I found is that that is actually the opposite. Like, regardless of if men were gay, queer, straight, across ages, that there was often really strategic decision-making around clothing. And so what I found in that, one of the key findings in that study was that men would often select clothing that conformed to the norms of masculinity. So the norms of like suiting or muted colors or like, you know, things that are less bold. If they were in situations that a job interview, a presentation, and even for men that had less traditionally masculine styles, engaged in more like gender play in their clothing, right, for issues of like safety, they were often knew when to like tone down or cover up when they were on the subway or when they were navigating spaces or when they were in an Uber. And so there was very strategic decision making. Sometimes men who held privilege, right, knew how to dress when they were moving into that job interview, or they were, you know, giving that presentation. Or for others, it was if they were traveling through spaces that weren't safe, how do I then present a more traditionally masculine appearance? Mm-hmm. And I think this was not, I think, you know, this research was not a critique in any of these men's practices, but it was more looking at the culture in which we live and really that what pressure to live up to this ideal or expectation of masculinity and recognizing what happens when you don't and the risks and repercussions of going against masculinity, right? That actually has very real world and like individual impacts, whether that's not getting a job, whether that's not being taken seriously, whether that's right being harassed or beaten up when you're moving through space. And I think, yes, it shows very much the how fragile masculinity is, and also the power of fashion that, you know, that people use to navigate space and move through the world to protect themselves.
Yeah, like code switching through your wardrobe, essentially.
Yeah. And I mean, we see this even more. I mean, for example, I mean, particularly men that, right, were, I mean, you know, like men who are racialized, men who were like trans, men who are larger, also really were making strategic decisions because they knew the way in which the world would read them and knew that if they were going to move through particular spaces, whether those were white dominated spaces, whether those were spaces with particular codes, that this is how I would dress to move through this space in a particular way. And reap the benefits because otherwise there would be great risk. And I think it really recognizes, right, that almost unconsciously as we, how we read people and how they're dressed and how we're dressing often for safety in ways. And I think this was important around masculinity because often, and even for men with like the most privilege or power, it's not a conversation we talk about or think about. But it was something that was really evident in the decisions that they were making, which shows this fragility of masculinity and the strategy that goes into selecting clothing.
Yeah, and I do want to actually talk about that as well. But I'm curious, you know, when you were talking to these individuals and kind of exploring the way that they made their decisions around the wardrobe, were they, in terms of the consideration and the things that they were taking in and considering or using as ways to dictate what they were wearing, was it through like a male gaze, like in terms of like, were they dressing themselves because of the way that they wanted to be perceived to other males or just society in general? Like, was there a specific kind of, I guess, audience that they had in mind?
Yeah, I think it was generally like a societal gaze, right? Mm-hmm. This like one that like assumed, right? That assumed a particular type of masculinity and was uncomfortable if that was challenged.
Yeah.
And that I think that pressure was very real. And that allowed, you know, this very just careful navigation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So speaking of fragile masculinity, you also said in a Harvard Business Review op-ed that you, that quote, while masculinity is often held up as the epitome of strength and power, it is actually quite a fragile identity because it's always at risk of being broken, which I thought was super interesting, especially given the time that we're in right now, to explore kind of like our notions of fragile and also just toxic masculinity, especially through the lens of style and fashion. Do you think that, you know, society is threatened by men who just don't conform to our typical masculine norms, even when we say we celebrate individuality and creativity, even in the fashion industry?
100%. I think that there is still so much buy-in and investment in a traditional gender structure, that when that is broken or when that is challenged, right, because it's constructed and artificial, and when that's challenged, that can be really unsettling for people. Mm-hmm. Unsettling because that is how, you know, people may have like always thought about themselves, how they've navigated and understood the world, and often it becomes something very personal, right? Someone else's gender has nothing to do with you, it's about them. But I think that then that opens questions often that you've never asked yourself. And that's certainly been a big part of the work. And I think part of this work is also then what is the role of fashion and what is the role of dress in actually starting to unpick that gender hierarchy that ultimately oppresses everyone. Mm. And how can fashion be an opening for these conversations? And one of the elements of that project of refashioning masculinity is with all the participants, we did a public fashion show at TMU. So we took over the gym that was like in the basement. We set up, you know, a runway, chairs, lights, all around the weights and just throughout. Yes. Like, throughout. And the 50 participants in the project, like, you know, picked some outfits. We took quotes from their interviews and played them over a speaker, and they came out in their outfits. And part of that fashion show, and we invited the public, the media, the industry, and the goal was really just to create a conversation around masculinity, to try to start to unpick some of the ways that we've held on to these really dominant notions, the way that actually is oppressive, and the possibilities of fashion to break that open and just create a more liberatory space. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is recognizing that if men who hold the most power can do that, right, can have those conversations, can play with fashion, what then might that open up for others that are more structurally marginalized and maybe feel there's more, who have more pressure to conform in order to navigate a world? And so that was a big part of that conversation, was to have men across cultures and bodies and, you know, disabilities kind of come together, play with fashion, be on the same runway, and create this larger dialogue. And I think ultimately that is why I love fashion. And that's where, like, I'm inspired by this work, is that fashion is not just, right, how we dress our bodies, but it says so much about, you know, how we claim identity and like can dismantle hierarchy in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in so many ways, like, fashion and style can be about, you know, liberation. But it can also be a little bit about restraint too. Like, there's two sides of that coin. Going back to your statement around, you know, masculinity being based on context, why do you think why is it that power, particularly for men in arenas like politics or finance and business, almost always seems to be visualized through the lens of restraint, where it's like a sensible watch or like a navy suit or like neutral tones? Like, why is there that association between those two, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think this is where context matters. Mm-hmm. So I think that in traditionally masculine industries, if we think about law, if we think about finance, if we think about particular businesses, these are associated with dominant ideas of masculinity, right? That are associated with strength and power and rationality. And in these things, right, having this almost uniform of the suit. And obviously there's a whole history of the suit and like the ways it like doesn't necessarily reveal the body, the ways, right, it conforms to this sort of particular aesthetic, right? That is often then a traditionally masculine sartorial expression in this particularly masculine space that conforms to those values, where it becomes, right, less about the individual, less about, right, the look, because the look is seen as feminine and thus equated with being frivolous. Mm-hmm. And then it's, right, this traditional masculinity that the clothing represents. But I think I've also seen that if men who are working in more creative spaces in fashion, there's actually can be power then in embracing more, you know, experimental flamboyant aesthetics. And like whether that's someone's true aesthetic or not, often in those spaces that can be seen as a way to reap benefits, because it's associated with being creative. It's being associated with being, with like the values of that space. And so like, for example, like folks in the research I did that worked in more creative fields and fields that maybe are associated with femininity, right? They were also strategic about like their choices of the glasses or like a scarf around their neck or these particular accents and elements that represented the values of that creative space. Mm. And I think, you know, part of it is, are we using fashion to become our whole selves and experiment? Or are we using fashion because we feel pressured by the workplace we're in or the context we're in? And that might be a hard question to ever fully unpack. Yeah. But I think that's also at the heart of it, is are we really using fashion again for this liberation? Or is it about this conformity to navigate and succeed in a particular space, because the risks of not doing so are too great?
Yeah, that is actually really interesting, because I feel like I've noticed from like a trend standpoint or like a collective style standpoint, there does seem to be this rise in like maybe a quote soft masculinity, where we're seeing more, you know, people wearing nail polish, pearl necklaces, you know, even skirts. Does seeing that feel like progress to you, or like more like performance and like being able to switch according to the context of the situation and the environment?
I mean, that's a great question. In some ways, I think it's certainly progress, right? I think representation does matter. Mm-hmm. And I think as we see more and more like men, mask folks, like also engage in expressions of fashion, accessories, right? The body that have been associated with femininity, right? That does open up possibilities. But I think the question, and this is often what fashion is famous for, is very often, right, fashion loves to take expressions that have been associated with structurally marginalized communities, like take them on, claim them, and then those become associated with power.
Yes.
So very easily, right, nail polish could be reclaimed as this, right, symbol of queerness or femininity, and now become this symbol of hypermasculinity. And its original origins and meanings and associations are wiped out, and it's become recoded. So I think the question in much of this is like, how do we make sure we're paying homage and crediting, we're doing, you know, citational justice to the origins of where styles come from, and are working not to recode those meanings? And that, I think, is not only on the wearers to do, but that's on the fashion industry to do, right? That's when in fashion communication and fashion design, like the ways in which we narrate styles, we talk about styles, we talk about design inspiration is really important to ensure we're doing that citational justice, to make sure that we're engaging the right communities, to making sure that we're not recoding just to reassert hierarchies. So I think that would be my question on nail polish, right? Is like, and I think that's a good question for wearers, but it's also a question for the fashion industry. So the soft boy aesthetic, is really honoring like this rupture of masculinity and really honoring like its origins versus just now being recoded as a new form of like hegemonic, dominant, like straight white masculinity.
Mm-hmm. It's why I think this year's Met Gala is going to be so interesting, because there is a real opportunity, I hope, is realized to kind of understand the origins and the roots of style within through the lens of culture and community, and why we're seeing that reflected through fashion and sartorial dress. So we'll see what happens there. What I also think is really interesting too is perhaps even a bigger arena than the Met Gala for talking about the influence of style is like politics too, because fashion is political. How do you think that like the notion of respectability and also like, I guess, like power, control, dominance, like how do you think that those have been interwoven with style and our notions of masculinity as well? Because we do see a lot of things like, do you remember like when like Obama was criticized for wearing that like tan suit and it was a sign of a lack of respect? But there's also like examples like Zelensky and, you know, his uniform, and even Trump. Like there's, wherever you are on the political spectrum, there are examples of how your style in politics has an impact. So I guess the question is, how is that related to, or where is the line drawn and connected between style as well as power and respect?
Yeah. I mean, I think we just have to, when we look at images parties put out of candidates, when we look at like leaders' debates, when we look at even debates in our own community, right? Like how often are we seeing, again, this hegemonic aesthetic, right? Or this like consistent aesthetic of what is deemed respectable. And often that is because, right, it's a particular arena that is demanding a particular look, and recognizing that if a politician goes against that, right, if they're seen as being too interested in their clothing, particularly, I think, for men and mask-identified individuals, then that's seen as something that takes away from, right, this quote-unquote professionalism or their time they're going to put into the work or their ideas, right? There's this idea that playing with fashion isn't evocative of your, like, creativity and critical thinking and, like, ability to think about space in the world, but it's this frivolous, unimportant pastime, right? And that's often with this connection of fashion and femininity, where that's come from. So I think that there's pressure on politicians to, quote, look the part, which is about respectability. And I think that's certainly a cross difference, but even more so for communities that have been structurally marginalized or that are structurally marginalized. And I also think that if we do see a politician, particularly a male or mask politician, play with clothing, we'll often see that. That'll often be taken up as, right, a joke or as something to, right, like critique them on or something that their ideas aren't real. And then that's then used against them. So it's almost easier to blend in, because if you don't, right, you then put yourself at risk. And I think that says, right, maybe not only about like the fear of the fragility of masculinity, but also the ongoing fear of femininity, and particularly male femininity, and how unsettling that is within like a Western or global Northern like society.
Yeah, because it's defined in two ways, in that like of what it is, but also like what it isn't as well, and how we kind of where we land between those two. We've kind of been talking about it throughout our conversations, but what would you say your research has shown about the role that overall fashion plays in disciplining or liberating the male body, especially when it comes to fat, disabled, or non-binary bodies as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think, right, fashion does both, right? It certainly like constrains and liberates. I think, as we've like talked about, right, part of the challenge right now, or part of the main, you know, fashion has embraced inclusion in many ways, but it has primarily been representation on the runway, in magazines, right, in these very visual platforms. And I think that's important, right? Because we're starting to see more diversity, certainly from a media, on the fashion media landscape. Mm-hmm. But where we're not seeing that is then when we look around who is designing clothes, right? Who is around the decision-making tables, both in the business of fashion and the design of fashion? Where are the diversity of ideas that are, you know, coming into the final designs, but also who's getting credit and authorship? And so part of, I think a lot of the work that I've been doing has been thinking about how do we make sure that we are providing access for generations of really like folks with diverse lived experiences to move through fashion school successfully and then move into the industry. And of course, fashion is always, right, has always had like a diverse workforce, right? If we think about garment makers and we think about like seamstresses and tailors, right? But who is making the final decision? Who is getting credit? And right, who is sort of receiving all the rewards from doing this?
And that's directly tied to like power and influence.
Exactly. Who is the power and influence? Because often many of the mishaps that fashion has made around its lack of diversity, around cultural appropriation, around not really thoughtfully engaging in size inclusion or in adaptive fashion, right, in ways that are really strategic and thoughtful and sustainable, are often because the people making those decisions are not part of those communities. And it doesn't mean, right, that there can't be room for a diverse group of people around the table, but I think that you definitely need folks from the communities who are wearing the clothes to also have key leadership roles in the business and in the design table. And from an education standpoint and from certainly an industry standpoint, one of the questions is, well, then what are the barriers that prevent that from happening? And so, you know, I talked about Sinead at the beginning. One of the programs we started at Parsons this year was the Parsons Disabled Fashion Student Program. Mm-hmm. And so this is a recruitment mentorship program for disabled students that want to go into fashion design. That provides tuition support, you know, living support, material support, but also provides mentorship, networking, community building to support them moving through fashion school. And then our commitment to work with industry partners to say, okay, then what does an internship look like? What do careers look like afterwards? And how can we provide those pathways? And how do we bring right stakeholders to the table to think about, okay, then what does access look like? And right, access, not just physical access to an atelier or design studio, but often thinking about the pacing and speed of fashion, right? Like this constant pressure to turn out all these collections, right? That assumes particular ways, particular, you know, people work, particular bodies and minds. And so how do we start to kind of rethink some of these principles that actually not just are excluding people, but are also limiting the potential of the fashion industry to really thoughtfully and sustainably expand into new markets? Mm-hmm. And I think that those are some of the ways, right? By having more diverse business people and designers around the table, we're going to then stop, we're going to prevent the risk of starting a size inclusive line and then closing it 2 months later, or doing, you know, engaging in adaptive fashion, but actually not really engaging disabled people in the process, or like doing it in a way that only conforms to a very narrow, you know, kind of straight white aesthetic. And so I think that that is a lot of the work. And I think, right, fashion schools have, you know, a responsibility not just to teach, you know, all students to be able to design for all bodies, right? If you're graduating with a fashion degree, you should be able to design for a variety of sizes and bodies, but also what's our responsibility to ensure that we're bringing people with diverse, like, fashion experiences and fashion bodies to the classrooms and then out into the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, with regards to the Parsons Disabled Fashion Student Program that you started with Jenny Burke, what has been the greatest challenge in cultivating that program? And conversely, what has been the greatest joy?
I think part of the challenge is recognizing that the process of fostering access is slow. It happens through learning, and that we won't know everything at the beginning. So really knowing that access is relational, it happens as we move through experiences, right? We might think at the beginning, okay, like the student might think, this is what access looks like for me. This is what we're going to do in a fashion class. But actually, as they move through the class, access might look like something different. And then it's not just about that one student, but it really is an institutional change, right? I think at the heart of anything around inclusion, it can't just be about one student or one class or like one program. It has to be the ethos of how an institution operates. Mm-hmm. So I think, right, the challenge is, as we're, you know, bringing these students through and supporting them, is it's not just these individual students. It's not just their courses. It's not just their instructors that we need to work with, right? But how do we ensure that as we design our curriculum from the core, that access is incorporated as a foundational principle? And I think that in certainly the work I've done at Parsons and thinking at TMU, that that's really been critical is, you know, diversity and inclusion can't be this, like, it can't sit outside of the ethos and the strategy of the university. It has to direct it, certainly within the fashion school.
Yeah, bake it in.
Yeah, exactly. and I think the joy has been being able to like help build something, right? Being able to say that like this was not here before and we're going to do the work and it's going to be challenging and it's going to be cultural change. But to actually say like we, you know, there's now six students in the program who are moving through, you know, that we're actually starting to build something that hopefully will not just impact these students, but like will impact, you know, cohorts and cohorts after them, regardless of if they're part of the program or not. But mm-hmm. creating access for these students will start to create access for other disabled students at Parsons, both who are there right now and after them. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really building, it's that, like building something that wasn't there and creating that change that's been like super rewarding.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like speaking to that, what do you think has been kind of the biggest cultural shift you're seeing amongst your students or even your instructors as well when it comes to just the opening of minds and perspectives and how people want to engage with the world around them?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of them is, right, often when we think of fashion, we think of the visual, right? And we often are teaching students in education to think about how does this garment look on the runway? How is it going to be photographed by a magazine, right? It's a very like ocular-centric perspective. Mm. And as soon as we start to center access, it's like, well, how do we actually move to embracing fashion as a multi-sensory experience, right? How do we realize that how something looks is important, but also how it feels on the body, how someone can take it on and take it off, right? You know, the sounds it makes, the way it moves through space, like how do we actually start to design fashion and value fashion as multisensory? And I think that's something in some ways, like as wearers, we know, right? We're very attuned to what it's like to get in and out of an outfit, how fabric feels against our skin, right? Like that like body fashion connection is there, but it's not something that we're often talking about, certainly in fashion media, and it's not something that we're often teaching in fashion school. And so I think that one of the changes is really starting to center this like this multi-sensory approach to fashion design as being critical, that it's not just the look, but it's the feel, it's the touch, it's the sound, it's like, and again, like, yes, this is about access, but it's also moving away from this access as being compliance, like you have to follow these legal mandates, and actually like, oh, if we start to center multisensory fashion, what creative possibilities that open up in how we can actually design and think about the fashion design process.
Yeah, it's super interesting. You've also talked about in the past the concept of gripping masculinity. Can you explain what that means and what that opens up as well?
Yeah, so the project that I've just been finishing is this project called Cribbing Masculinity. And crip, I think similar to like queer or fat, is a word that's often been used as like a slur against disabled folks and many in like disability community and disability studies scholars have sort of reclaimed that word as like a identity and a site of pride. And also I think in academia, like similar to queer, is also used as this like disrupting this non-disabled experience or less ableist assumptions. So like to crip masculinity is like to really challenge the ways in which ableism is centered in masculinity and open up these like different ways of performing and doing masculinity. And this project, I think very similar to the refashioning masculinity. It really kind of grew out of that, included these amazing wardrobe interviews that we did with about 50 different disabled, deaf, and neurodivergent folks in Toronto and Edmonton. And this was done during the pandemic, so all online, and kind of doing these virtual wardrobe interviews. And then included these like fashion hacking workshops where we worked with them to take a garment that didn't express their identity, didn't fit their body, have them lead a design process where they imagined how would they redesign this, and then providing that support to recreate that garment. And then the last phases were a fashion show that we did, and an exhibition, A Tangled Art and Disability, which is an art gallery in Toronto specifically showcasing disabled artists.
Very, very cool. So speaking of wardrobe, you know, is there a garment or designer that has personally changed your relationship with masculinity and your perspective on style through that lens?
I think one of the benefits of being, you know, dean of a fashion school is that I am always surrounded by our students, and seeing what they're creating in their classes, what they're creating for their thesis, that for me is my inspiration. And there's not necessarily one student, but I think I'm really interested in the ways in which, and you know, both at TMU and at Parsons, like we have students that are actively playing with gender and playing with masculinity, and not just disrupting, but creating like new pathways and new expressions of masculinity through clothes and through these multi-sensory experiences. And I think for me, like anytime I get to go to an event, we do our Parsons Benefit every May, which is our big fundraiser for scholarships. And I love being able to wear student work to that and be able to like perform and embody types of masculinity that I didn't even know were possible. And I think that's what I love about fashion is I think that like really it's putting the garment on your body that allows you to become new parts of yourself that you didn't maybe know existed inside of you. And certainly like understand new forms of gender and masculinities that you never thought of. And certainly that's what fashion does for me, and wearing student work does that. I think the other thing I love about student work is that because the classroom almost operates without the constraints of industry, right? There's not, right? You're not necessarily thinking of, oh, this is my supervisor, this is the creative director, this is, you know, the pressure. Like there's really this freedom to design and to play in a way that allows these new expressions of like, you know, masculinity and gender in general to come to life.
Yeah. Yeah. Last question here. What is your, you know, what would you like to see happen in the fashion industry in the next 5 or 10 years? If you could have one change kind of like ripple throughout those years, what would it be?
The major change I would like to see is the conversations around diversity and inclusion not being a conversation, but just being a practice. So we move away from counting how many white male creative directors there are. We move away from counting that there's less or more plus size models on the runway or black models on the runway. And instead we are really talking about the ways diversity and inclusion opens up incredible creative expression. And we're just talking about the amazing fashion that's available for everyone that expresses a variety of culture. Because ultimately it's hard. Yes, fashion is political, right? Yes, it's about, right, like power, it's about marginalization, but it is also about fun, right? I think there is something like incredibly fun, incredibly joyful about accessing clothes that not just like fit you, but allow you to play in the world and discover new parts of yourself. And I think that if diversity inclusion is just the ethos of how we work, then that will be a possibility for everyone. And we'll move away from this conversation of like counting and talking about bodies that don't have access to fashion, and really just be able to focus on the joy that fashion can offer us.
Yeah, we don't want to keep score anymore. Let's just bake it in.
I mean, we have to until we get there, right?
Exactly.
Make sure there's progress. But yes, moving away from that score and like focusing on like the joy that fashion can bring to all of us.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds like a pretty nice idea. Hopefully we'll see it happen. thank you so much for the chat. I really enjoyed it. And I always love talking about fashion and style and culture and how it's just, you know, I feel like people don't think about how much influence and impact the things that we wear and the way that we present ourselves. You know, it's a decision you make literally every day. And that has a ripple effect, right? And so I just, it's a topic that I love talking about. So I really, really appreciate your time. I know you're a very busy person and just appreciate your insights. I think, you know, people are going to love it, hearing about it.
Well, thanks for the great conversation. I loved it too.
Thank you. That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go and make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.